Good. So we've been exploring, we're going to go back to exploring what is the Dharma. Last week we had this wonderful interlude with Ratnaguna and Padmavaju exploring themes from Ratnaguna's new book. If you weren't able to come last week, do see if you can catch it on our YouTube channel. It was a lovely, lovely evening. And the previous week, Suryagupta was teaching and had a brilliant exposition of the distinction between the conditioned and the unconditioned. And the relationship between them. I'm going to touch on that again. But this week I want to move to another section of this book, What is the Dharma? And it's called, the chapter in here, Sangharakshita has called it the mystery of the void. The mystery of the void. So I thought, that's what I said I'd talk about. Actually, I'm not going to talk about much of what Sangharakshita says in here. I'm going to just kind of riff off the mystery of the void and see what happens. Although I might touch on some of what he says in here. It is definitely worth reading. I'm just not sure that I can completely kind of do it justice, what he says in here. But have a look. And as I say, I might touch on it. So, the mystery of the void. What Sangharakshita in this section is trying to communicate is the essence of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. It's in a way the heart of the Buddha's wisdom that is being talked about when he talks about the mystery of the void. And that experience, pranya, which is the word for wisdom, isn't something that you can explain in words. It's not something that is open to conceptual understanding. It is an experience. The Buddha, 2,500 years ago, had an experience that completely transformed his consciousness, and then led him to help others transform their consciousness for the rest of his life, for the 40 years that he was still alive. 45 years, he went around helping others break through into the experience that he had had. And down the centuries, that is what the Buddhist tradition is still all about. It's trying to point us to an experience, a transformative experience. It's an experience that liberates us from all pain, all mind-made pain. As long as we've got bodies, there still will be physical pain. But all mental suffering, it liberates us from that. It not only liberates us from dukkha, it reveals to us in an experiential way the nature of phenomena, the nature of reality, the nature of all experience. It is, in a way, opening us up to what's really going on. The Buddha's experience of wisdom is sometimes talked about in terms of seeing, and it's said that an enlightened being sees things the way they really are. Sees things the way they really are. That seeing, which isn't a physical seeing, because the Buddha would have still seen what you and I see. His eyes were still human eyes, and visual perception was still the same. The seeing that is being talked about is an imaginative act. It's an inner kind of seeing. It's a knowing. It's a realization. And that seeing of the way things really are liberates us. As soon as one sees the way things really are, there's a liberation. And the rest of the Dharma, everything that the Buddha taught and everything that has developed in terms of teachings throughout the centuries, is all aimed at helping human beings to see the truth, and in the seeing, free ourselves, and then help free others. The whole of the Dharma and all its teachings is aimed at that. So sometimes in the Zen tradition it's said that that the Dharma is a finger pointing to the moon. And that's really useful to remember. The Buddha himself talked about as his teaching as being a raft to ferry you from one shore to the other, from samsara to nirvana. It's not an end in itself, it's a means. Which means that all the teachings have to be applied, their methods to be applied, their tools to be applied. They're not dogma. They're not dogma to be believed blindly, nor are they to be taken literally. They're metaphors, they're pointers, they're practices, they're methods pointing to something that can't be talked about but can be experienced. So that's particularly important to remember when we start talking about things like the void or shunyata. Shunyata is what's being referred to when Bhante talks about the void. Shunyata is sometimes translated as emptiness. And literally, that's not a bad translation of the word. But actually, the connotations of emptiness are all wrong. They're completely kind of wrong, at least from our perspective, our Western perspective. Because as soon as you translate shunyata, which is said to be the essential nature of all things, as soon as you translate that as emptiness, our minds can't help but think that that means there's nothing, that everything is somehow a big black hole and we're just going to get sucked in if we haven't already been sucked in. There's just nothing. And then Buddhism is accused of being nihilistic. It's said, you know, people who don't understand Buddhism would say, they take a word like shunyata and they think what's being got at is some sort of nihilistic philosophy that nothing is real and therefore everything is completely non-existent and a big black hole. So that's one of the dangers of a word like emptiness, that we misinterpret it, we grasp it with our literal kind of minds, we think we know what it means, and we miss the experience that should be liberating is missed, and what instead happens is we take the most profound Buddhist teaching and with our small, narrow consciousness, we grasp it literally, and then it becomes one more obstacle, one more fetter binding us to conditioned existence. So in some traditions it's said that we shouldn't teach about shunyata to those that aren't ready. That if they hear the teaching of shunyata and they're not ready, it'll become another obstacle. So the safe thing would be to do would be to just for me to shut up and you to all meditate, or us to meditate, or just go home and have an early night. At least that wouldn't be an obstacle to your progress. I'm gonna sort of risk venturing where I shouldn't, and talk as best I can about what is being got at. It comes with this health warning that if you take it in the wrong way and you take it literally and you forget that it's pointing to something that is an experience that really can't be talked about, if you forget all of that, then you'll end up on a wrong track, leading to a brick wall. Okay, so with that health warning, let's look at this word shunyata, and see what it's trying to get to. Well, in a sense, you've already heard what the teaching of shunyata is trying to point to, because it's not really different to the teaching of conditionality. It's not really different to what we've been talking about for a number of weeks now, which is the core teaching of the Buddha, that everything is arising and ceasing in dependence upon conditions. Everything is part of a network, probably an infinite network, of constantly changing processes or conditions. Nothing is fixed, nothing is static, even for an instant, even though so-called solid objects look like they're static, looked closer, they're not. Nothing is static. Everything is in a state of movement, of becoming, of interacting. Everything's part of this infinite network of conditions. That's very true of us, isn't it? It's very true of us. We sometimes go about our lives unthinkingly, thinking that we are a fixed object in a fixed objective world, and we just bump along, trying to get what we can, what we want, rearranging the world where we can to meet our needs. And when it meets our needs, we think of that as happiness, and when it doesn't, we think that's pain. Yeah? That's our kind of standard common sense kind of wandering through. But when you look more closely, it doesn't take much consideration to realise that we're part of the world, whatever the world is. We're part of the environment. It's not that, you know, we're just going to kind of destroy the environment. We're part of the world. Everything, every time we breathe, we're taking in the world. Every time we eat or drink, we're taking in the world. This stuff that we call flesh and bones and blood, it is, it's grown from the world, from the elements, from what we've eaten, what we've ingested. Every time we exhale or urinate or defecate, we're giving back something into the environment. We're as it were, we're an open system. We're not closed, we're interacting. That's what life is. If we were closed, that wouldn't be life. We'd be dead. We'd be static, but dead. Yeah. We'd be sealed and static and inert. So it's true of us that we're interacting, that we're this set of conditions that's constantly in flux with the world around us. That's true of us. But Buddhism says it's true of everything. It's true of everything. It's true of this book. It's true of the floor that you're sitting on, the mat. It's true of everything, that everything is in a state of interacting flux. It's not static. It's not fixed. It's not separate. So that's what we've been kind of exploring for a number of weeks, this truth of conditionality. Conditioned existence. One of the things that we've looked at is that if everything, when something is conditioned like this, it can't be said to have an essential nature to it, because it's to have an essential nature, it's got to be something of itself, whereas a conditioned arising is nothing of itself, it's just a phenomena in relation to other phenomena, interacting with other phenomena. It's not a thing in itself. So this was the truth, the lakshana, the characteristic of anatta, of insubstantiality, of non-selfhood, that nothing has an innate nature to its to its own self. So I think a few weeks ago I talked about this book, and it's very easy to say, oh, it's an object, but it's not an object that can exist in isolation to the world. It didn't come into existence out of nothing. It wasn't just kind of miraculously kind of born out of nothing. It comes out of a set of conditions, including the wood, the trees, the environment that it comes from. But also, of course, there's Sangharakshita, who's the author. He comes out of a set of conditions, including his biological family. But then all the conditions that he, in his 90 years, has experienced, that shaped him. Amongst the conditions that have had a profound effect on him are the teachings of the Dharma. He came across the Dharma in his early teens, mid-teens, in London, through translations of some Buddhist texts, including the Diamond Sutra. The Diamond Sutra is possibly, well, it's said to be, you can see a copy of it in the British Museum, it's said to be the oldest written text that we've got. So I don't know quite when it dates from. But somebody wrote that text down for the first time. Somebody else translated it. The Buddha is said to have given the teachings that were later sort of formulated into something like the Diamond Sutra. Then when you look at this book, it's actually a transcription of a series of lectures that were given, I think, in the 70s. Somebody's actually edited those lectures. There's words on the page in this book, or at least what we would recognise as words. If you didn't speak English, they would just be meaningless marks. They would be marks. We have to give them meaning. That means that we share a common language where we can understand the words. That's part of the network of conditions that enables a book like this, without everything that's gone into the development of the English language. I could go on and on and on. You see that you can break this phenomena that we call book down into all the conditioning factors out of which it arose. And it's, of course, it's still changing. It's become more and more dog-eared as I flick through it. It's interacting all the time with its environment. If you were to plunge it into flames, which you don't do with sacred texts, but if you were to, at some point, you know, initially it would be a burning book. At some point, you wouldn't be able to recognise it as a book. It would be ashes. It would have transmuted into forms that wouldn't have ever been recognised as book. Yeah. It's constantly in flux. So that teaching of anatta is another way of talking about shunyata, that there is no essential selfhood or substance behind anything. That's one way of talking about shunyata. But I think it's, so far, that teaching of conditionality feels relatively easy to understand, doesn't it? It's not particularly mysterious. It's not how we normally think, because we go about life without thinking about such things a lot of the time, but it's still relatively easy when you do apply some thought to it. But it gets a bit more complex or a bit more mysterious when you go into this teaching a little bit more, because what the Buddha said was not only does everything arise in dependence upon conditions, but that everything is dependent upon the mind. That everything is dependent upon the mind. All experience, all phenomenal existence, the whole of conditioned reality is dependent upon mind. He said that the world was mind-made. So now we start to get into a bit more of a mysterious dimension So far, common sense would say that there's still a real me and a real world. There's still a real you and a real world. But yes, okay, we've conceded, hopefully, that that real world and maybe the me in it is a network of is born of a network of conditions, and it's in flux and interaction. But it's still, you could still believe that there was a real world out there with a real sort of you in here, albeit now you're a fluid thing and the world is fluid. But the Buddha's saying something more profound. He's saying, no, the world isn't really objective and out there. It's mind-made. It's mind-made. So I'm going to pause there and ask you to think about in what ways might that be true. What ways would you say the world is mind-made? How does that make sense? Why? In what ways would that be true? See if you can think about, well, is it true? But more than that, in what ways is it true? How could you say that your experience, the world, everything that happens is mind-made? A few weeks ago, I asked some schoolboys this. They were 16, maybe between 15 and 17. And they came up with all the right answers. Anyway, no pressure.
I'm not sure if I'm undersimilizing these 16-year-olds, but say I'm trying to understand something. Often for me, it's a lot easier if I talk it through with somebody.
Let's stick with this theme though. Can you think of in what ways is it? So, oh, is this, are you coming to that?
Yeah. Okay. So, I don't really know what's going on.
Mm.
And then I start talking to somebody. Mm. And then my mind starts to understand.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean. Yeah.
So then, I've sort of got all the information there. Mm. It's not until sort of a weird kind of condition about talking about it. Mm. Then I start to understand it. It's all there before me, but I just don't understand it yet. And I guess for me, that's how I sort of understand it, being more and more.
And it's not even, well, I don't know, my experience is not only, because that happens to me, in a certain sense, I don't have the full experience until I've started talking about it.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point. It's sometimes said that the Buddha, so he had this experience under the Bodhi tree, which is this ineffable experience. But it said that it wasn't really until he communicated it to another person that it became complete. Part of this, I think we have a need to articulate, to communicate, and to ourselves, but often we do that through talking out loud to another human being. And in the talking, we bring it into being. Yeah.
And it also makes me think, oh, if I didn't know that without talking about it, what else is going on?
Yeah, that's right. The creative act, I mean, you know, when an artist produces something, they're bringing something into being. And in a way, they're doing that through the act. It's not like, I suspect, it's not like the artist has everything worked out and then they just write it down or compose it or sculpt it or whatever it is. The process is the act of creation, and talking, communicating is analogous to that, I think. Yeah. So yes, that's one way in which our experience is, you could say, is brought into being through mind. Any other ways, though? Yes.
Well,
going back to what you were saying about the kind of like book and understanding the book, the only reason why we understand that the book is like a sacred thing, it's the thing that we're learning from, is because we understand our mind works out the meaning that each of those words, each of those squiggles,
yes,
are completely meaningless.
Yes.
Our mind understands them, and
yes,
our mind creates meaning, and our mind creates meaning of the candle,
yes,
making light, which means something more.
Yes.
And so it's in that way, it's like, that is a thing, and you are the thing experiencing it, but it doesn't, it isn't a thing until your mind has said,
yes,
that's what it is.
That's right. So, like, even now, if I listen to you, as I was listening to you, and you're listening to me, to somebody, that again, that didn't speak English, it would just be meaningless sound. But what's happening, because we do speak the same language, those sounds are creating... The words are, in a way, just symbols and metaphors, and they're creating meaning, understanding, in your mind. And if the understanding is what I meant you to understand, or to the extent that it is, we're communicating. Somehow my mind, or your mind, and my mind have met. An idea that was... in the book is now being communicated through, you know, what could be just sound into consciousness. And it's only when that happens that they become words. And yes, the candle. So what you were saying there is that there's this visual thing, experience, but seeing it as a candle is a conscious conceptual act. Well, maybe not conscious, but it's a conceptual act. And then you're also seeing it as a symbol, as a metaphor, and it means something else. It takes on a resonance. You know, we don't actually need candlelight in this room. There's light enough. They're on the shrine not because we need the light, but because they're a symbol of the enlightened mind, and that symbol speaks to us more or less consciously. So that's a mind-made act, isn't it? It's an imaginative act. Yeah, so that's good. Thank you. Idoya, come back to you.
Is it about phenomena then, or about meaning?
Yes, so...
it's a different thing, whether the meaning might be created in terms of symbols, and what I put onto that, but the candle is there.
So that's good. So that takes it a little bit deeper. So far, what Knut and, I don't know your name,
Jamie.
Knut and Jamie have been talking about is more about meaning. Although meaning then creates experience. But you're now asking about phenomena, and you're saying the candle is there, regardless of whether I interpret it in a symbolic way or in whatever meaningful way. So can you say in what sense the candle is there? How do you know?
If I go and touch, or if I put my hand over it, I might get burned and see it. But even if I don't, if Ollie does it,
yes,
it will be there for him.
Yeah.
Or for someone else.
Or get Ollie to do it. So let's look at that a bit more carefully. The first thing is that you said the candle is there. The candle is there. So as soon as you say candle, or I say candle, we've created a label for what? For some sort of phenomena that seems to be happening around here. But if you look at this phenomena more closely, it's not a fixed and static thing, is it? And nor is it a single thing. It was a composite. You know, it's a mixture of wax and what we call wax and other things. It's not a something. But we have to label it in some way to talk about it. And for convenience sake, we give it one word, a noun, and call it a candle. You look at it more closely, and it's some mysterious process that's going on here. Yeah?
Over time.
Sorry?
Over time.
But it's not static over time. So the candle, this thing, now, is different to now. Yeah? It looks pretty much the same, but if you were to really look, it's different. The flame will have burned some of the wax. The flame is constantly changing. It's not a static thing at all. Okay. But then you talked about touching it. So I can touch it. So I can feel something. But if you look more carefully, what we assume is that if I can feel something and it feels solid, then it must be there. But when you look more closely or think more closely about what's going on, when you encounter something solid, well, what is it? What is that? What is going on? What would anybody? What's happening? Yeah.
Our mind interprets it, processes the information given by our senses, and decides this is wax, this is solid. It's all.
That's right. Because we've got little nerve endings in our fingers. Yeah. So these, if I didn't have those nerve endings, or if they were damaged, I really wouldn't feel this. I wouldn't feel it, but I've got these nerve endings. They seem to encounter something here. But remember that nerve endings themselves don't produce sensation. All nerve endings do, and I don't know my biology any more than this, so you have to... What do nerve endings do?
Signals to the...
Yeah, they send electrochemical signals to the brain, and then somehow, mysteriously, the brain processes those signals and creates a sensation of touch. That's all going on incredibly rapidly, and we just think that we're touching what's out there. So already the sensation of touch is weird, isn't it? One of the schoolboys was talking about how solidity is an illusion. And physics would tell you that. Physics would say that everything is made up of atoms. And atoms are mainly empty space. They contain tiny little, smaller subatomic particles, but most of the region occupied by an atom is empty space. This is mainly empty space. And then those tiny, tiny subatomic particles aren't solid either. They seem to be better described as just little condensations of energy that temporarily manifest for a while. We don't experience, you know, my hand doesn't pass through this. Why doesn't it pass through this? We experience it as solid. Does anybody know the physics? No?
The forces in the candle repel the forces.
Yeah. So there's little subatomic particles called electrons on the surface of this thing called a candle, and then there's electrons on my hand, and those electrons repel, the charge on those electrons repels the charge on the electrons on the candle, and that stops your or my fingers passing through the wax. Nothing is solid. It just appears to be so due to, well, the forces operating. and how we perceive things.
Can I just ask?
Does that start to? Let me just stay.
Yeah, I can understand. So that for now, for that instant, you still can go through the candle. For that reason, which I can understand why, how it's happening.
Yes.
Because it is like that, you still can't go through.
You still can't. No, that's right.
So even if it's peaceful now, and I know it's changing.
Yes.
There's still a candle there now, or what we call a candle, which I know is made of all these different elements and conditions, but temporarily.
Ah, well, that's a different point. So it is useful, and you're right that no amount of me talking about this being empty space is going to allow my fingers to go through it. Yes, you're right. It's the experience is of solidity. The experience is of solidity, and that is useful. It's useful for getting around, it's useful for lighting a candle. But what Buddhism's trying to separate out is, okay, you've got experience, but is that experience pointing to the truth? Or is that experience being misinterpreted? And what I'm trying to say is that when you look deeper, the experience is just an interpretation. I mean, we're misinterpreting it. If we think that there's a real solid thing here, that's a misinterpretation. Now, when you talk about candles, that just seems academic. You think, well, why do we need to think like that? It's just that this misinterpretation of an objective world out there that's solid or tangible and existing independently of me, that interpretation is the cause of all pain. So that's when it becomes more important and urgent. It's the interpretation that's wrong. Yeah? And an enlightened being would still be able to touch a candle and light a candle and even call it candle. But at a deeper level, they would always be aware that solidity is an illusion. That there's nothing really there, separate from what the mind has created. Yeah? That's not just true for touch, it's true for all your five senses. So anything that you see red. But if somebody in this room is colourblind, they will be seeing something different to probably what most people are seeing. They may still call it red, but their experience will be different because the experience is happening in the mind. It's not that red is out there. Red is an experience. Something is happening out there, perhaps, but red, what we call red, is an experience in the mind. And if you were colourblind, or if you were an animal that could only see in black and white, the experience would be different. The same is true of hearing, isn't it? We know that hearing is happening in the mind. We know that sound is just vibrations of air. I was at this exhibition on Saturday, the Other Worlds exhibition that Fingal was recommending at the Natural History Museum, and you've got all these incredibly beautiful images, these photographs of the solar system, of the sun and of the earth and of the other planets. I was particularly struck by the images of the earth and of the sun. And the sun is this incredible huge exploding ball of gas. Exploding is not quite the right word, but it is. It's a nuclear fusion. It's an explosion that's happening with the most enormous amount of energy that we can't even begin to comprehend. It's happening. The incredible thing, though, for me, watching these kind of images of the sun, is that if you were close to it, you couldn't hear her. You wouldn't be able to hear her, because there's no air in space, so there's no sound. The sun doesn't make a sound. This enormous explosion, more than you know any number of explosions on Earth, every second, it doesn't make a sound. The sound is a mind-made construct. If there's air and ears and the right type of consciousness, you will hear sound. In the absence of any one of those things, sound doesn't exist. So sight, sound, touch, smell, taste, everything that we experience is happening through the mind. So perception is mind-made. And we don't know what's out there without our perceiving it. If this book isn't really red, red is an experience in the mind, what colour is it really then? And you can't say. Yeah? Colour is a concept. It's not intrinsic to the book. Everything's a concept. So perception becomes mind-made. Meaning is mind-made, as you were saying. Anything else? You
actually covered exactly kind of what I was going to say. I was going to use the colourblind kind of analogy. But really, that we all create our own individual realities.
Yeah.
Really touching on what you were saying, that everything is different for every single one of us, and it's only the way that we process that information and whether our emotional attachment to something could be different for what we have learned through our own personal lives and our own recognition of something is completely different individually.
Yeah.
And so therefore itself, it becomes something different.
Yes, that's right. So on the other hand, we are, we all of us have the same senses, at least if our senses are working as they should do, then your eyes and my eyes will be having a similar experience. Just because we've got human senses. If we were a different kind of species, then we'd have a different experience. But yes, it's also true to say that each of us is creating our own world, our own reality. So that starts to touch on something that will be familiar to all of you, because you've all experienced meditation. And probably all of you know that when you've had an absorbed meditation and then you open your eyes, for a while, your perception is different. Is that a familiar experience? In what ways does it feel different?
Clearer.
Yeah, clearer. Visually clearer. Yeah. Any other? Yeah, there's a sense, isn't there, of you're not so caught up in it, that awareness means that you can not be so attached, and you've got a little bit more freedom from what's happening. You can observe it with a degree of detachment. Yeah. Any other experiences of what it looks like when you've been meditating, it feels like?
All your senses are heightened.
Yes, all your senses, that's right. All your senses are much, much brighter and sharper and clearer. It feels sometimes like somebody's just cleaned everything, doesn't it? And wiped polish over everything, and then suddenly everything's gleaming. Everything seems brighter. I wonder if artists sometimes experience the world more like that. Painters, I wonder if they experience the world more like that. I can remember looking at a Turner painting about a year ago, and you know, I'd seen it before, I'd seen it many times, but it was as if I was, well, I walked into the Tate Gallery and we looked at this Turner, and it was what's his name, climbing up the Himalayas. Anyway, I can't remember. We looked at this Turner, and you know how Turner paints light, and everything in this painting was glowing, as if from within. And then there was the light around it. Everything actually was just interfused light. Everything was interfused light. And for a while, I'd just come off a solitary retreat where I'd been meditating a lot and having heightened experiences of perception. Perception was, on my solitary at times, it was like everything was glowing. There was a sort of imaginative sense that light was the nature of everything, and I'm talking sort of metaphorically, but that was how it felt. I mean, that was how I experienced it on solitary at times, albeit not very long. And then I came and saw this Turner, and it was like Turner was painting my inner experience, my meditative experience was being depicted on canvas. And this painting somehow, it sort of seemed to assault my senses. That's how it felt, actually. It threw me into a meditative state that felt both blissful and a bit, unnerving. And for the next couple of hours, I walked around the South Bank. And it was as if I was seeing through Turner's eyes. I wonder if he saw things as made of light quite a lot. And as I walked around the river, it helped that the sun was low and setting, and it was beautiful. Everything was glowing. The river was reflecting the sunset, and the light was bouncing off the buildings, and the buildings, like the Houses of Parliament, looked particularly beautiful. And everything looked as if it was made of light. It was more than that, actually. I couldn't... The experience was that not only was it made of light, but the nature of the light was metta, was love. That's how it felt, that everything was made of this shimmering metta, that was visually, it was light, and it felt, its emotional sense was love. And that what I normally saw as just inanimate, solid things were just crystallized, condensed light that was of the nature of love. Now, I'm talking metaphorically, I'm talking poetically, and yet for me it was an incredibly real, vivid, strong experience. Bhante says that when you see things as shimmering with a life beyond them, as if something is shimmering through them, glowing, then you're closer to seeing shunyata. That's what emptiness is trying to get at. That rather than living in a world of externally existing, objectively existing, solid, inert things, with a me that's also real and physical and solid, that everything, it would be closer to say, is of this kind of glowing, shimmering nature, sort of pulsating with life and love and energy. That would be closer. And if we could really see that more, So for me, when I saw this Turner painting and then looked out at the world or at other people, all I could see was love. And it wasn't just that it wasn't just that I was in a metaphor state, although that was part of it. It was almost as if light and love was what was there. If we could experience that, I believe that that's... I'm not saying that that's the same as enlightenment. All I'm saying is that I believe that it's a glimpse of something truer than my normal everyday experience. And if I could live more from that, then I know that I would be free of any mental pain. And that love, metta, empathy, compassion, connection, bliss, wonder, joy would be a natural state all the time. And that the world wouldn't be just an objectively cold thing. I would be part of it. I'd know I was part of it, interacting it, forming it, creating it. And if we could do that, then our world would be transformed. It really would be transformed. So I think this is what that's teaching is pointing. Well, it's pointing much beyond that. I've just given you a wee glimpse of, tried to hint at an experience that I had, which was just a wee glimpse of something a little more real, a little more true. Shunyata in its fullness would be more than that. It's sort of a limitless experience. It is an experience, though. When the Buddha tried to describe it, he used words like shunya, empty. Things are empty. We're creating them all the time. The mind is part of that. And is it incredible that by working on your mind, so meditation is an example of how that works, by working on your mind, you purify your perception and the world is different. The world is different. So in the tea break, I was saying that if enough of us were doing this, we would create a world within a world. And I think that actually we already always occupy the world that we're creating. We already do that. It's just that we can choose, if we want to create a better world. We're already living in a world that's mind-made. I have a friend who used to be a drug addict and a dealer. And... he was saying that, you know, when he used to walk around Bethnal Green, he saw a world that I couldn't see, which was of that underworld, that dark underworld, which, you know, somewhere is still around the streets of Bethnal Green. I couldn't see it. So I'm blissfully unaware of it. And look at the cherry blossom. And... we were occupying, I mean, he's no longer trapped in that world, but he used to be. And what he was saying is that wherever he went, that world would be his experience. That's a state of mind creating a world. The world is mind-made at all of those levels. There's this lovely story of a samurai in Japan, a medieval samurai, not a medieval samurai, a samurai in the medieval age, meeting this Zen master, this old Zen master. You know, the samurai goes up to him, and this young, proud man, this warrior, and says to the samurai, tell me what heaven is and tell me what hell is. What is heaven? What is hell? And the Zen master just looks at him, this old, wizened man, I like to imagine, and he says, you're an ignorant oaf. You're nothing but a clod, walking around dressed in your armour and your finery, and you think you can come and talk to me and ask me about the Dharma. I wouldn't teach you if you begged me, you ignorant oaf. And he continues in this way. And the samurai, nobody speaks to the samurai like that. And he immediately takes out his sword, his sharp sword, and says, how dare you? How dare you? I'm going to cut your head off. And the Zen master says, that is hell. And then he puts his sword back, humbled. And the Zen master says, that is heaven. Isn't that wonderful? Wonderful little... The mind really does create the world at all sorts of levels, at all sorts of levels. From meaning, interpretation, collectively we take those meanings and we form views and systems and cultures, all of that, every aspect of culture is mind-made. Then you look at perception and you say, okay, well surely something must be out there. You look a bit more closely, and you don't know what it is. All you have to concede is that, yes, these senses are being interpreted by some sort of consciousness as this. When you look deeper at the level of modern physics, at quantum physics tells us, and I know quantum physics might be wrong, etc., but it tells us at the moment that even those subatomic little particles don't exist independently. They come into being, they change when you observe them. There's something about even the fundamental building blocks of what we call matter that seems to be influenced by mind. In that sense, it's conditioned by mind, it's mind-made, even in that sense. And then, of course, I've just touched on our consciousness colours our world. Our emotions colour our world, and our level of sensitivity, our awareness or metta or lack of colour our world. They create our world. So the world that we experience, we can't say that it's objective and out there. It is dependent upon mind. The incredible thing about Buddhism is that it says not only does the world not exist independently, the world is mind-made, the world is, as it were, shunya, it's empty of independent existence. But then Buddhism goes further and says, don't think that mind is a real thing, just creating the world. Mind too is empty of any nature, of any substantial nature. Yeah? There's nothing to base our experience on. So sometimes Buddhism says, it uses the analogy of a dream or a magic show. In a dream, all sorts of things can happen. All sorts of experiences, pleasant and unpleasant, can happen. You do have an experience of space and of time flowing. You have an experience of your senses, of other people, of objects, of colours, of perception, of sight, of sound. And then when you wake up, none of it was real. It was all mind-made. All of it was mind-made, wasn't it? The analogy is the same, that this waking experience that we take as really real, it's actually mind-made. But the mind that's making it is also not real. Yeah? So that's really weird, isn't it? So but that doesn't mean that nothing's happening. It doesn't mean that nothing's happening. So when you have a dream does seem to be happening. At the time, you are having an experience. And when you wake up, it might still leave some sort of residue of emotion or feeling. It does have an effect. Similarly with this waking state, it's not that nothing is happening. Experience is happening. It's just not what we think it is. It's really not what we think it is. And it's because we solidify, literalize, objectify our experience that we suffer. If we could really experience the emptiness of things, the shunya nature of things, there'd be this letting go of all craving, and there would be this liberation that was blissful. And that would be, as it were, our natural state of consciousness. That's what consciousness is, if we didn't imprison it in its cage. So I've said more than enough. I've gone on over time, so I'll leave it there. Perhaps just one more thing to say is that all I've been talking about, if you think you've got it, I hope you haven't got it. If you think you have got it, you really shouldn't think that. Because then you will have just created an obstacle for yourself. Bhante says that shunyata is not just a mystery. He quotes Churchill and says, it's a riddle within a mystery encased in an enigma. Shunyata is not something you can understand. It's an experience to be had. The reason that it's worth talking about at all is to encourage us to keep practicing so that we can one day experience it for ourselves. That's what we do. Yeah? Good. Thank you.